Political insiders know that whoever controls the legislative and congressional maps in Ohio pretty much control everything for at least a decade. But most voters don't give a second thought to the fact that year after year, a Democrat or a Republican is elected to the State House or Congress with little or no opposition in their district. That doesn't just happen. It's the product of what is called gerrymandering, or drawing the lines to favor one party or another. This year, voters are being asked to change that process from one controlled by elected officials to one managed by a politically balanced, or hopefully a politically balanced and appointed commission. Supporters say it would remove politics from the equation. Opponents, though, say it would take away the accountability. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher today. Today we're going to parse those arguments, and with us to do that is OSU political science professor emeritus Richard Gunther. He helped write Issue 2, and he speaks for Voters First Ohio, which supports Issue 2. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Columbus attorney Bill Todd. He's speaking for Protect Your Vote Ohio, the group that opposes Issue 2. Welcome to the show, Bill Todd.
Thank you, Ann.
And with us is Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel, who has been covering Issue 2 to help me pick up the pieces. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
A question for our listeners. Do you know what Issue 2 does? Is it something that's important to you? Do you understand what redistricting does? I would love to know what people out there think about the issue of redistricting and how it affects their life. So, Bill Todd and Richard Gunther, first of all, do you both agree that the present system is broken, that something needs to be fixed? Richard?
Yes, I certainly
obviously do. You do, because you wrote the issue too, but...
Right. There are many ways in which this system needs to be improved. One of them is the process itself. It is supposed to take place in public. The legislature is supposed to be drawing congressional lines. But as we know, the real decisions were made in Suite 601 in the Doubletree Inn, which they themselves called the bunker. It was clearly behind closed doors, and it was quite clear that the criteria were highly partisan and led to congressional maps that strongly favor Republicans and make it almost impossible for voters to remove incumbents from office. There are no competitive districts out of those 16 districts. The three closest are a margin of victory that's predicted of 8 percentage points, and that is regarded basically as a landslide by most reporters. And all of the other districts are completely uncompetitive. And what that does, it makes it impossible for voters to hold their elected officials accountable.
Bill Todd, what about you? Do you agree that there's a problem that needs fixing?
And I do. I think that the point that Professor Gunther made is an important one, and that is the lack of transparency that's been perceived in this process. I think that most people in the general public would like to have a more open window into how this process proceeds. Now, whether the solution that's been proposed here, Issue 2, is a good one or not, I think is a different issue, is a different question. And frankly, I don't think this is a good solution to the current problems.
You used the phrase lack of transparency that is perceived.
Yes.
So there is not really a lack of transparency. It's just that's what people perceive.
I believe that that there is an importance in the perception that it's not a transparent process. Ultimately, it is something that does have to be done in public. But the development of the proposals is something that has not historically been done publicly. And I believe that today our voting public would prefer to see more transparency at an earlier stage in the process. So I think that's the perception, and I think that's probably an accurate problem.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Issue 2 this hour. If you have a question or comment, want to tell us what you think about Issue 2, do you know what it is? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim Siegel, Columbus Dispatch, Bill Todd also used the phrase most people, saying most people would want to see a change. Do you think most people even know what the problem is?
There's been some polling done, and oftentimes when the Ohio newspaper organization or the Dispatch does polling, we will follow up with some of the respondents and get their thoughts. And there is a lot of confusion and misunderstanding about exactly what is being done here. I agree with the two gentlemen here that if people really understood what was happening, then I think they probably would favor some type of change, favor more transparency. because as Bill just said, while the votes have to be taken in public, that's the law. The actual development of the maps are very much done in private.
Which is the way a lot of legislation is done.
Yes, but not to this degree. Most legislation, you don't see it. You don't see it presented as a full completed product and then voted on within 48 hours without any real public discussion of why it was created in the way that it was. There's a lot that's been revealed about why these maps were created by public records requests that came after the fact. But frankly, I just want to make sure I'm clear, this is not a partisan problem. The Democrats.
It's not the Democrats did it when they were
right.
in control.
This is not something. There's no way a knock on the Republicans. Republicans do.
Right.
They're using the system to their advantage, just as Democrats have done in the past when they've had the power. Now, while this has been a very partisan fight over issue two, that is more a result of who's in power. Republicans drew the maps, and if this were to pass, the maps would change almost immediately for the 2014 election. So regardless of whether, you know, who thinks it's a good or a bad idea, the Democrats see this as a way, at least in the short term, to get some new maps drawn, and Republicans see that as a problem.
Richard Gunther, opponents of Issue 2 repeatedly have turned to the funding issue as a reason to oppose it. They have said that the new commission would have a blank check to spend taxpayer money. And, of course, PolitiFact.com has debunked this notion, saying that the commission would only have the funds necessary to do the job. There's no cap, but that doesn't mean the commission would spend whatever it wants. But in California, according to a spokesman for the Anti-Issue 2 group, a similar commission spent $10 million drawing the new lines. Is this pretty much in line with what you anticipate as one of the authors of Issue 2? What can we expect?
I think the cost estimates that have been set forth by the opposition are really inaccurate. We actually ran a statewide competition using the same procedures that we're talking about here for $115,000. The idea that this would cost between 10 and 15 million strains credibility. Now, I want to point out the current process costs about 2 million. So we're not saying that this can be done for free.
It doesn't go from 0 to 100
That's
miles
correct.
An hour. Okay.
But there are a number of things in here that are really unusual. First off, the Ohio Supreme Court ruled 6-1 that the claim that this is a blank check is factually inaccurate and prejudicial and ordered that language removed. Nonetheless, our opposition continues to make that assertion. But when you take a look at the budget that was drawn up by the Director of Management and Budget for Governor Kasich, you find some really bizarre things. For example, salaries of $100,000 for each of the members of the commission, which is 25% more on an hourly basis than the governor's salary. Second, they budgeted $2.3 million for the period from 2013 to 2020, when this commission has no work to do. It really is a padded budget. And since the legislature is in charge of giving funding for this process, I find it hard to believe that our legislature would be so fiscally irresponsible as to waste money in that manner. We think it can be done for much less.
Bill Todd, PolitiFact.com, the Ohio Supreme Court has spoken. The blank check reference is not an accurate or fair representation, but are you concerned about money nonetheless?
And I think that Professor Gunther underestimates the power of government and government bureaucrats to inflate budgets. And so I do think it's an accurate estimate of the cost. That's not the primary concern, however. I think that the one factor we do have to consider is that, and you see this all the time in legislative fights, as you mentioned, the more transparency there is in a process, the more expensive it becomes because more actors become involved in the process. And they want to come out and have their voice heard as it's going through and it's being generated. If we started off with a law that said that the maps had to be revealed publicly, the initial draft, 6 months before they could be finally voted on, I can assure you it'd be a lot more than $10 million in that fight. Is that worth it? I think it is. I mean, I think that the transparency is worth the cost because it's such an important process. So from a cost standpoint, it will be more costly. No, I don't think it's a blank check. The legislature will always have the power to control. But that's not fundamentally the problem with Issue 2 from my perspective.
What do you think fundamentally is the problem?
And Professor Gunter and I have talked about this before over many years now. One of the things that I think that we start off here with issue two is an assumption that you can render what is inherently a political process to be a nonpartisan, nonpolitical decision by creating a commission which is insulated from anyone who has been an actor, an active participant in the political process, by having the members selected in a way that there is little or no political involvement in those selections. I think that's a wrong assumption. You are always going to have politics in a process that's so inherent and embedded in the political system, such as redistricting. And I think in some cases, what we've seen, for example, in California, Iowa, and some of the other states that have redistricting commissions, politics hasn't been stripped from the process. It just moves in a more subtle way and in a less transparent way.
Richard Gunther, fundamental flaws like that, do you agree? I mean, it does. I was thinking that it is a multi-layered process just to get to the maps. The League of Women Voters has said that it supports Issue 2 because it calls for an impartial districting process with opportunity for citizen participation. But how do citizens, just ordinary citizens, really participate? It sounds like you still have to be pretty plugged in to get on that commission.
Well, we actually field tested this twice in 2009 and 2011. We had statewide competitions where ordinary citizens were given all the software, all the data that they needed, and we assembled 67 maps. And ordinary citizens had no difficulty in doing this. In fact, it was amusing to me that one of my undergraduate students was the author of one of the maps. It's quite clear that given adequate instructions and adequate data, that fair, impartial decisions can be rendered that will at least offset some of the serious partisan balances that we currently have in our system. The most important thing that would constrain the members of this commission is they would be specifically charged with trying to maximize four criteria. Two of them we currently have in the Ohio Constitution for state legislative boundaries, and that is geographical compactness and community preservation. We wouldn't change that. What we would do is add to that the criterion of competitiveness, in which it would be instructed to create as many competitive districts as possible. Now, we know that you can't create competitive districts everywhere because people reside in areas that are politically homogeneous sometimes.
And they often live near each other.
Exactly.
They agree with whom they agree.
Yeah, right. That's right. So we have a fourth criterion, which is representational fairness, that you should balance off those districts that favor Republicans with other districts that favor Democrats so that what emerges in the end is something that would reflect the actual preferences of voters. And we were able to find that ordinary citizens could do this, and every one of the 67 maps that was generated is better than our current map and is better than the one that will go into effect in this forthcoming election.
We are talking about Issue 2 with Richard Gunther. He is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at OSU. He helped write Issue 2. Also, Bill Todd, he's partner in Axelrod, Todd and Aliberti, and he is speaking against Issue 2. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And just to remind you, Issue 2 is asking voters to change the process of how we draw our legislative and congressional district lines, change it from one controlled by elected officials to one managed by, the idea is, a politically balanced and appointed commission. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The first Tuesday in November, just around the corner, Superstorm Sandy put a stop to the top of the tippet campaigning, but as water recedes and lights come back on, the Obama and Romney campaigns will rev up for the home stretch. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin, Anna Greenberg, and Matt Continetti join us for the countdown to Election Day. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 41 degrees with cloudy skies. We could see some rain today, a high of 45. A rain mixing with a little bit of snow tonight, a low of 36 degrees. Still a slight chance of rain Thursday, then some sunshine and a high of 50. Support for 89.7 comes from the other paper, Columbus's News and Entertainment Weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about Issue 2. You'll see that on your ballot when you go to vote, or you've seen it already when you went to vote. It's asking voters to change how the lines for the legislature and Congress are drawn. Change it from a process that is controlled by elected officials to one managed by an appointed commission. If you have a question or comment on that, you can join the conversation. 614-292-8513. Joining me now, Richard Gunther, professor emeritus of political science at OSU. He helped write Issue 2, so obviously he's for Issue 2. And also with us, Bill Todd, Columbus lawyer Bill Todd, who is speaking against against Issue 2. Let's go to Barry. Hi, Barry in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a more of a comment than a question. First of all, I'm an independent, and I have already voted, and I will tell you that I did vote in favor of Issue 2. My question really is, how can the current process be considered fair when you look at the distribution of voters across the state? Mm-hmm. Ohio is roughly half Democratic, half Republican. Yet the congressional districts are very predominantly Republican. I understand that obviously the Republicans right now have been in charge of drawing the lines, but should the Democrats get in power, obviously they would do exactly the same.
They have, and
I would assume they would do the exact same thing given the opportunity. But there's got to be a better way, whether it's Issue 2 or another way of going about this, of drawing the lines that are fair and competitive.
Okay.
And I'll take your response off the air.
Okay. Both our guests today, Richard Gunther and also Bill Todd, have agreed that there's a problem. But from where you sit, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, you've covered this at least once, maybe a couple times. How do they keep a straight face, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, when they put this out there and say that it's somehow representative of the state?
Well, the caller asked, how do they argue this is fair? Well, they don't. They argue it's legal. That's the legislature and the apportionment board don't focus on fairness. They focused on legality and whether their maps will withstand court challenges. And ultimately, if they can draw a map that is as beneficial as possible to their party and yet will still withstand a court challenge, that is a successful map. And that is just the way the system works now. And it's you can argue whether it's a good or bad process, but it's not really about fairness. It's about legality.
Critics have incorrectly said that the commission would be chosen in secret. And the Ohio Elections Commission has ruled that can no longer be said as well. But there are scant details, or it doesn't seem very clear, about how the commission would be chosen. What sorts of criteria would be used? Richard Gunther, are you concerned that there's maybe too much left up in the air in Issue 2 when it comes to picking the commission members?
No. In fact, I think our language is excessively specific for many voters. I think there's a lot that they have to read to understand, and that's a problem for us, quite frankly.
Too complicated.
But we wanted to make certain that this would be about as fair a process as one could design. So ordinary citizens can nominate themselves. Then we obviously have to screen those candidates and winnow down the total to a reasonable number. And that is to be done by a politically balanced panel of appellate court justices appointed by actually selected at random under the supervision of the Supreme Court Chief Justice. And what they would do is simply review the files and interview the candidates to make sure, as they would if they were presiding over the selection of a jury, that individuals with the capacity to make impartial decisions could be appointed to the panel, and obviously make certain that they have some of the technical abilities to understand the various complexities of this issue. They would basically do nothing more than select 14 Republican citizens from those who applied, 14 Democrats, and 14 of neither party. Then there would be the preemptory challenges, if you will, by the leader of the majority party in the House of Representatives and then the minority leader in the House of Representatives. They could eliminate as many as 9 individuals, creating a pool of 24, 8 Republicans, 8 Democrats, and 8 independents. Then they would be selected at random, by lot, so that we would create a panel, an initial panel of 9. But then those 9 would select the final 3, 1 Republican, 1 Democrat, and 1 independent. And the reason we did this is one of our concerns is that the commission must reflect the diversity of the state of Ohio. And if by random chance we were to select 12 white men, or if we were to select by chance no representative from northeastern Ohio, that clearly would not reflect the diversity that we want to see. And therefore, they would be targeting those kinds of individuals to balance that out.
It sounds a lot like, Bill Todd, you're the lawyer picking a jury to a certain degree. And there is some just human, you know, instinct that goes into that at a certain point. But they're also looking for sort of a balance. Why do you object to this system?
And I think that there are a couple objections. The first is a constitutional objection. Both the State Bar Association and the Ohio Judicial Conference have come out against Issue 2 because of the what I think is probably one of the most serious errors in the way that this was drafted, and that is involving our judiciary at all in this kind of political process. They would prefer not to be involved. In the case of the Supreme Court, ultimately, the court might actually have to rule on some decisions made by the Redistricting Commission. And for them to be involved, any of the justices involved in any way at any part of the selection process gives them a conflict of interest, which I know that the court has expressed concerns about. So that's why the State Bar and the State State Judicial Conference have been opposed to this. But I think more fundamentally, I think, again, we're back to this issue of what are we really looking for in a redistricting process? Can we really say that we're going to meet some utopian ideal of a fairly balanced panel that reflects all the diversity in the world and that it's going to remove politics from the process? I think the answer to that's no. And that, you know, I tend to look at this as similar to what our founding fathers did when they tried to draft a framework of government for us. They recognized fully that there was always going to be politics and various forces contending in the political arena. And that the way to do that, to deal with that, was not to ignore it or pretend that you could make it go away, but what you needed to do was create a system of checks and balances. And that's really what led to not almost everything in our constitutional form of government, but both at the federal and at the state level.
Yeah, Richard Gunther?
Yes, I absolutely agree, and that's why we built checks and balances into this commission. There are 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats and then 4 individuals of neither party. So it's quite clear that no one party will be able to dominate that process. More importantly, though, what we've found nationwide where there are citizen commissions like this, they tend to reach decision not along strict partisan lines, but rather by building broad consensus. The California panel, for example, approved its congressional map by a vote of 12-2. In the case of Idaho, the congressional map was approved by a vote of 4-2. And in the case of Washington, the congressional districts were approved by a vote of 4-0. So it tends not to be this very narrow partisan stance that's taken by citizens. They actually do have the capacity to reach fair decisions.
Bill Todd?
And the one thing that I think that, again, Professor Gunter is missing here, and going back to my background as a lawyer who's been involved in political matters for many years, is, and I know there's an acknowledgement in this draft of it, that you have to be sensitive to federal constitutional issues. But ever since Baker versus Carr in 1962, the whole area of deciding what the districts are for either state representation or members of Congress has been heavily overlain by federal constitutional decisions as well as federal statutes. So that one of the things here that I think is, that our listeners need to think about is that it is highly problematic as to whether this proposal could survive constitutional scrutiny in a federal court. And I'll just give you one example. I believe that the criterion of competitiveness, which they're trying to interject in the process here, runs directly afoul of some of the issues that need to be considered by the legislature under the terms of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That tends to dictate a lot of how the line drawing is done and the need to be sensitive to the focus and the requirement that a state be sensitive and inclusive of minority voters and allow them to have an opportunity to ensure minority representation.
How would competitiveness, that criteria, affect that?
Well, competitiveness from an overall standpoint would suggest that you have to have a winner and a loser that are in equal pose. Under the Voting Rights Act, where we have a requirement to try to create majority-minority districts, that tends to mean that we're going to have Democratic districts that are going to be served by a minority member of either the legislature or the Congress.
Would tend to. I guess I'm not sure what you mean by minority.
Minority, as in, for example, in Ohio, I think it's primarily we have to be sensitive to the African-American
okay.
minority. In states like Texas now, they have to be sensitive not only to the African-American minority, but also to Hispanic issues so that they get into a very complex set of issues, which I know they did this past year in their map drawing, as to how do you balance those minority-majority issues against competitiveness.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Jim Siegel, has this issue been raised in the political community that serves minority voters in Ohio as a problem?
I don't know that it's been raised necessarily as a problem this time, although it's always a concern. I've talked with members of the Legislative Black Caucus about this issue months ago, and that was one thing they were looking into is – and one of the reasons that it has been a struggle over the years to come up with a redistricting plan that both parties will favor is that if you do things like competitiveness and compactness and put some of those factors in, there is sometimes a concern that what would that do to minority voting districts? Now, you can there are certainly arguments to be made that you can do both, that you can keep minority majority districts and still adhere to some of these other criteria. But at the same time, you know, one of the things, you know, when you're talking about political gerrymandering, one of the things is, you know, you pack people together who are of like ideology, and basically creating minority-majority districts does that. They create very, very Democratic seats normally, and that tends to cuts against some of the goals of what some groups would like to see in terms of fairness.
I want to get to another caller, but Richard Gunther, you wanted to make a brief comment there?
Yes. In our competition, our citizens who submitted the 67 maps had no difficulty in reconciling the maps they were drawing with the Voting Rights Act. The difference is that in the case of, say, the 11th Congressional District, clearly there needs to be a majority-minority population, but you don't need to have 80% as a majority. I mean, that's clearly packing excess Democratic votes to deny neighboring areas of the votes that might actually have elected a second African-American member.
David and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
This is good that you're covering this because this issue doesn't get a equal coverage on TV very much. And I think it's an important issue. I think Professor Gunther has got something here that he's not making any money on this, and he's doing it because he thinks it's good for Ohio. And I think this is a fair issue, and Mr. Todd seems to say that if it's not perfect, well, we got to reject it, which doesn't make any sense at all. I think the issue tries for fairness, and it tries for equal representation, and there's a lot of districts in the state that citizens aren't represented. They just keep getting these same politicians constantly, and they're not being represented. And I think this would help with a little more competition in all the districts.
Okay. Thank you, David. You know, Bill Todd, we were talking earlier about alternatives, and they've been on the ballot before, and the voters voted it down a few years ago. Another alternative was on the ballot. Where is the political resolve? Because every few years, something pops up. Of course, Secretary of State John Husted, when he was Speaker of the House, had a plan out there that was not enacted. Where is ever the political resolve going to come from as long as the legislature is controlled largely by one party?
And I think it is going to have to come from people who are interested in the public policy debate from both sides of the aisle. As Professor Gunter knows, I had actually participated in a process about a year and a half ago to come up with a plan to work on changes in the constitutional structure of redistricting that would have been a much more balanced plan, not as radical as this and not without the, without the constitutional flaws, but something more along the lines that Secretary Husted has proposed, which I think was a very good start. There are always going to be diehards in one party or the other who are going to be opposed to any change at all because they think that they can get some last ounce of advantage out of the current system. But you know, you're going to have, I think, here going forward, maybe more of a consensus. And the one point I would add there is I think that one of the things that's changed in the legislature in during the years I've worked over there has been the impact of term limits on the legislators. You know, many of these folks aren't going to be there for as long as they used to be, and they aren't as concerned about how their districts work, so they might be more concerned about the, you know, what's the best interest of public policy. I just wanted to add for David calling in from Bexley, I'm doing this as a volunteer as well.
Yeah, I figured. I apologize. I wanted to point that out, too. Jim Siegel, what are the expectations for this going forward?
Well, there is a legislative task force right now looking at the redistricting issue. There's also the Constitutional Modernization Commission that has just recently been formed and will start meeting next year. This is a group of both legislators and outsiders who are going to try to craft different changes to the Constitution and recommend them to the legislature. There's an expectation that one or both of those groups will come up with an alternative plan. Basically, there's two ways to do this. You can either do this with a kind of a citizens commission, as is being proposed here in Issue 2, or you can try to create some type of a bipartisan panel of politicians to get this done, if you really want to make it a different process. The legislature has tended to, you know, when there has been any movement at all on this issue, they've tended to go with the bipartisan legislative panel. Let's face it, the lawmakers and the politicians, the political parties don't want to let go of this completely. But there is when there is a recognition this needs to change, they at least say, well, we should at least try to find some bipartisan cooperation.
Richard Gunther, I'm going to let you have the last word because we're running out of time, but I wanted to know, Is the legislative alternative, the ones that have been put forward already, is that something you could live with? Is somebody who, in concept, wants change?
We actually did this. We worked for an entire year trying to reconcile Senate Joint Resolution 5, which was John Husted's proposal, with what we got through the House of Representatives, House Joint Resolution 15, that included our criteria. We had no problem with trying to merge those two. And the only reason we switched to this citizens panel is that it was not possible to get this through the legislature. And I remain concerned about whether there is political will in the legislature to do the right thing with regard to creating a level playing field for candidates of both parties.
And Ann, I'm just going to add real quick, the two big issues that have held this up, aside from the obvious partisanship, is one, they can't decide on what criteria should be used to draw the maps and whether competitiveness should be a major part of that. And they can't decide what to do if the panel deadlocks how do you break that stalemate? Who does it?
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. We'll find out in about a week whether or not Issue 2 goes forward and is enacted by the voters or whether they go back to the drawing board. For now, Richard Gunther, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Richard Gunther, he's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State University and also Columbus lawyer Bill Todd. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be here.
Appreciate it. And it's Jim Siegel, as always, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Jim Siegel is with the Columbus Dispatch. He covers such things. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back and change the topic to another political issue, China. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
As Gemma, the fierce old lady of the biker gang in the FX series Sons of Anarchy, Katie Sagal has shot and killed people, pulled a gun on a baby, and other horrible things.
She's done quite a few. What, you know, might be viewed as heinous, but she does not view them that way.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Katie Sagal. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a discussion of John Quincy Adams, who acted as secretary and interpreter for the first American ambassador to Russia at age 14. And then more on contemporary politics. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow from 10 until noon. And for breaking news, in-depth features, and interviews with the candidates, visit WOSU.org/campaign2012. It's your one-stop shop for 2012 election coverage. That's WOSU.org/campaign2012. A chance of rain today, a high of 45. A chance of a little rain mixing with snow tonight, a low of 36 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from the Wellington School, where children are encouraged to discover and develop their unique potential in preschool through grade 12. Wellington will host a Lower School Family Visit Day on Tuesday, November 6th from 9 to 11 a.m. More at wellington.org. And support comes from Ohio Northern University, hosting Discover ONU Day Saturday, November 3rd, allowing families to learn about the blend of liberal arts and professional programs offered at ONU. Online registration and additional details are at onu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Both President Barack Obama and his GOP challenger Mitt Romney have raised the issue of China this year repeatedly, if you haven't noticed, in the debates and on the campaign trail. You might have heard similar comments in the U.S. Senate race between Ohio incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown and his Republican opponent, Ohio State Treasurer Josh Mandel. President Barack Obama has suggested that there's something wrong when jobs go to China.
He made money investing in companies that uprooted from here and went to China. Pioneers. Now, Ohio, you can't stand up to China when all you've done is sent them our jobs.
Okay, and President Obama was, of course, talking about Mitt Romney's work. Romney repeatedly has raised the issue of currency manipulation when it comes to China. Let's listen.
Let me tell you, on day one of my administration, I will label China a currency manipulator. We got to get those jobs back and get trade to be fair.
And this week, the Romney campaign has asserted in ads that Jeep is sending jobs to China, amending that later to say that Jeep will be opening factories there should be opened in the United States. It gets kind of confusing. Joining us now to talk about how our relations with this economic giant is used as campaign fodder and how such tactics influence voters. And what we really should be worrying about, Zan Lee. She's an adjunct professor of economics and finance at New York University. She's also a former visiting professor at Peking University. During that time, she advised Chinese economic officials as well as several large Chinese asset management firms. She's the author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China. Welcome to the show, Ann Lee.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Alexander Thompson. He's OSU political scientist and an international trade expert. Welcome to the show, Alexander.
Thanks, Ann.
So, China long has been a convenient target in political campaigns. The campaigns of it's nothing new. This time it's manipulating its currency. Before, it's been a lack of democracy. Ann Lee, from where you've sat, is there anything different about this election cycle?
I would say that the rhetoric is similar to previous rhetoric in many regards, and it's always convenient for politicians to blame an outside entity when a lot of the problems are homegrown, because it's much easier to target another and blame someone who can't be there to defend themselves than to fix political problems at home, as we've seen in many other instances where it's just difficult to move the needle when entrenched interests want to keep things the way they are. And so this is similar to, other China bashing before and then Japan bashing before that. But the truth is that, you know, I don't think a lot will change in terms of policy, whoever gets into the presidency. But the rhetoric is there to try to win votes.
Alex Thompson, how does this kind of campaign tactic work on voters?
I think that's a good question. Trade policy offers politicians a sort of populist red meat that seems to work equally well with both parties. If we recall, Obama was very critical of the NAFTA agreement while he campaigned. And then in office, by contrast, he has more or less embraced free trade like most presidents do. In terms of the international effects of this, I think the good news is that the Chinese government probably doesn't take it that seriously. My guess is that it's viewed in Beijing basically for what it is, which is campaign rhetoric. On the other hand, if it were implemented as policy, I think it could be quite destructive.
Ann Lee, the upcoming 18th National Congress of the Communist Party of China will usher in a new generation of leaders, possibly its current Vice President Xi Jinping, to oversee the world's second largest economy for the next decade. So what do we know about the new generation of Chinese leaders and how they view it from where they sit?
Well, they haven't announced all the new members of the Standing Committee, which mm-hmm. is the most powerful group in China, and this group of nine, and it likely will be just seven this time, really exercise most of, you know, the policy decisions in China. And I would say that from what we could hear from rumors coming out of Chinese newspapers, that, you know, this group is probably not going to deviate too much from what we've seen in the past, although I think there's consensus amongst those folks that they need to create some sort of political reform within China in order to reduce the inequality, reduce the corruption, and reduce the power of the party. And so there's a lot of discussion amongst them that this is important. Wen Jiabao already started that conversation with the public before, and I think this new generation will continue it. It seems as if the folks who are slated to go in are more positive to Western reforms, and so I think that hopefully they're more amenable to working with the U.S. government on making various trade policy changes, but we shall wait and see.
I guess, Alex Thompson, meaning that whoever, it's kind of like the 12 million jobs that are going to be created. There's probably 12 million jobs that are going to be created anyways in the United States over the next 4 years. In this case, changing our relations with trade relations with China, there's probably going to be change afoot anyways.
I think that's a really good point. I think the best way to approach China is to recognize that China isn't going away. The U.S. and China will be interacting as major players on the international scene on a variety of issues for decades to come. So I think it's important to approach the relationship from a very long-term perspective. This means building high-quality relations through diplomacy, through mutually beneficial agreements. There will obviously be disputes between the U.S. and China, and there are areas where U.S. and Chinese interests collide. But in general, there's no reason to approach our relationship with China in zero-sum terms. It can be mutually productive, especially when it comes to trade and economic issues more broadly.
Ann Lee, this is how Chinese state-run media responded after the debate. They said if President Romney, in quotes, was determined to keep his words by throwing punitive tariffs against Chinese products exported to the U.S. market on day one, then China perhaps would be forced to fight back, and then his administration would be very likely to be on its way to a global trade war. If on day one he did start the punitive tariffs that he talks about and promises, is that what you would expect to see? I mean, could it really happen?
It could happen, although sometimes the politicians can disguise their rhetoric with actions that don't really have any teeth in it. But we are already seeing it, frankly, under the Obama administration. When the congressional hearings on Huawei basically deemed them a national security threat, which was basically a political attack because there was actually no proof that they were. The Chinese has responded already. China Unicom basically said that, oh, we're discovering that Cisco routers could be a security threat. So there is this tit-for-tat that's already beginning, which is very dangerous if it escalates. And so I hope that, the politicians at the top will know better and rein that kind of rhetoric in once the election season is over.
It seems like, Alex Thompson, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Republican candidate Mitt Romney really got the ball rolling on the Chinese issue and our relations with China, but that the president has started to increase the rhetoric as well. And it makes me wonder, so there is something that really works with this, I guess, or they're just playing the odds. Usually they're not.
Well, I think we should distinguish between, sort of unilateral threats and saber rattling. History tells us tend not to be that productive. It usually backfires by leading the other side to dig in its heels and generates more support amongst their domestic public. For them and for taking a tough stand against us. I think one distinction we should make between what Romney is proposing, which is to challenge China's currency manipulation through retaliatory tariffs by the United States, would basically be a unilateral move. The way that the Obama administration has approached China has been fairly aggressive, but by and large it's been through the World Trade Organization and its dispute settlement mechanism, and through negotiations over a variety of issues. So that approach, the approach of the Obama administration, is fairly aggressive but still multilateral and within the framework of the World Trade Organization. So I think we should distinguish between that sort of approach versus potentially a more aggressive or unilateral approach.
Lynn in Central Ohio, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Diplomatically, China has been maneuvering, and they have been selling the idea that the U.S. has been prosperous for all these years, and now it's their turn to prosper. This has appealed to our higher nature in letting them have their turn at prosperity, and frankly, it has backed off other nations from taking steps to counter their misbehavior in this trade situation. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Okay.
I have talked with officials at high levels in the American bureaucracy in certain areas, and basically they are saying, well, the Americans are telling me when I talked with them, well, you know, it's their turn now. It's their turn now. And I've seen a Chinese diplomat on television on one show. He says, oh, well, you know, it's our turn to prosper now. The Americans have prospered for all these years, and you're using up all the Earth's resources,
okay,
far more than your share, and now it's our turn to prosper. And behind the scenes, okay, in secret negotiations, this is their approach. And unfortunately, too many in the higher levels of government, in our government, have bought it. So that's my comment.
All right. Thank you, Lynn, for that comment. Ann Lee, what do you make of that?
Well, I know I've heard that as well, but the truth of the matter is that the U.S. also prospers from this trade relationship. It's just that it is very uneven in who gets to benefit from it. A lot of the major Fortune 500 corporations actually had record profits as a result of selling to China, of outsourcing to China. And it didn't get filtered down to a lot of the workers, the CEOs, the investment bankers, the private equity firms. They all benefited immensely from this relationship. And so this is something that is not being explained to the American people. And so the relationship is much more complicated. And in fact, you know, I tried to explain in the Huffington Post that actually, you know, the existence of China can be a huge win for the U.S., and the U.S. can continue to prosper if only we had the right policies so that the distribution of that prosperity gets more distributed evenly.
Alex Thompson, you were nodding your head.
Well, I think I really like the point that Dr. Lee made about sort of the distributive benefits of the U.S.-China relationship. But I also like the more general point she made that Chinese prosperity isn't necessarily a bad thing for the United States. China's economy has been growing fast. It's inevitable. The rise of China, you know, as an economic power is inevitable. The upside, of course, is that over the long run, as China's economy continues to grow, and in particular as its middle class continues to grow, there will be more demand for U.S. products, and presumably over time, the trade imbalance that gets so much attention will even out to some extent.
Mark and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mark.
I had a question about perhaps if China has a soul over a barrel at this point, if we were to take our investments or our companies out and take them, say, I don't know, next door to maybe to India, which is a democracy, has a billion people, and they have an infrastructure, maybe not as good, but, you know, they, I'm sure they'd welcome the jobs, or perhaps Brazil.
Yeah, okay, so if we send the work out at other places.
Right. Now, I understand these three are together in some sort of economic alliance. I forget what it's called, but at this time, but if we were to tell the Chinese, like, you know, shape up or we'll pull out and go someplace else, would that help our interests, or would that just further the problem?
Well, let's find out. Yeah, Mark, I'm sorry, we're running out of time. I just wanted to make sure we got to your question. Thanks for that call. Is that something, Alex Thompson, that we can do as a nation? Because we're still, quote unquote, a free country. I mean, companies can do what they want with their assets, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are powerful market forces that are leading U.S. companies to invest in China. So, and the point the caller made that China has us over a barrel, the U.S. and China are dependent on each other and intertwined. So I don't see it as being nearly that lopsided. Another way to view it is that China is heavily invested in the U.S. and U.S. prosperity. After all, it has. Bought a lot of our debt and has an interest in the United States doing well.
Ann Lee, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me again. I really enjoyed it.
Ann Lee is an adjunct professor of economics and finance at New York University, and she is also the author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China. And Alex Thompson, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks, Ann.
Alex Thompson, a professor of political science at Ohio State University. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.